I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast about the unique heritage and local culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. Speaking of the Madawaska River, there's a place down near Combermere where the Madawaska gently flows past one of our area's most unique places. It's simply called Madonna House, and this September, it is celebrating its 75th anniversary. A lay apostolate dedicated to works of true Christian charity, nearly 200 people currently work at Madonna House, both at their main center of operation in Combermere, as well as in their many houses throughout the world where, among many other good works, they feed and clothe the needy. Earlier this month, our producer, Barry Conway, sat down with Mary Davis, who joined shortly after Catherine and Eddie Doherty opened its doors back in 1947, Mary Lynn Murray, who arrived there in 1981, and Christina Milan, who joined in 1996. All three sat down near the lapping river water, bird song overhead, and those less than enticing sounds of the passing speedboats, and the occasional plane taking off from nearby Negeague Lake.
My name is Mary Davis, and I was born in 1933 in Peabody, Massachusetts. My mother was from Antigonish, Nova Scotia, and early on, she went to the Boston area to find work, and she found my father. They married, and I had one brother, younger brother, and we lived in the Massachusetts area until just after the war, the Second World War, when my father took a job in Quebec. And there I went to a Catholic school with the Sisters of Charity of Halifax. And there was a connection even there that I didn't know existed until later. Like, our parish in Quebec was Redemptorist Parish, and one of our priests, Father Jim Dwyer, had a brother, Father Pat Dwyer, who was parish priest in Combermere. And now, I don't know if he was a cousin or brother, but Father Bill Dwyer was certainly of the Dwyer clan in Madawaska. Yeah.
I'm Mary Lynn Murray. Some people will know me as Lynn Murray. When I was a child, Mrs. Tommy Conway and Sister Mary of the Cross both called me Mary Lynn, which was my baptismal name, and I always preferred that, but I never had the gumption to ask people to call me that. So I was Lynn until about 30 years ago, and I go by Mary Lynn now, but I do answer to both. So I grew up in the valley in Barry's Bay. Dowdle and Rita Murray were my parents. My mom was Rita Levesque. She was from Maynooth. So I grew up, I guess what I would like to say is I actually, people ask me, so you must have known Madonna House. And I say, I never knew a thing about Madonna House, except this is where we brought our clothes when we outgrew them. I went to Madawaska Valley High School, and then I went to Queen's University. I entered the nursing program there. I graduated in 1981, and I was working in Ottawa when I first ran into Madonna House in a way that was sort of a lasting impression for me. Up until that time, I really knew nothing about the community.
My name is Christina Milan, and I was born in Toronto, Ontario. My family moved to this area in 1976, which was the year I was born. So I grew up the first year, 6 years of my life on a farm in Purdy, and my family became acquainted with Madonna House through St. Benedict's Acres, which is our local farm 9 kilometers from the main training center here in Combermere. So through those encounters in the area of farming, we also got to know the local mission, St. Joseph's House, which is just a few stone's throw down the road. Beverly Maciag was the local director at that time. And I attended the elementary school here in Combermere, the local parish, Canadian Martyrs, when I was growing up. Went to high school in Barry's Bay, and then after high school studied nursing in Toronto. Returned here to work at the Valley Manor nursing home in Barry's Bay, and then touched Madonna House for the first time, apart from my family's encounters, when I was really searching for a direction in my life. So that would have been 1996. I came for the first time as a guest.
Our high school in Quebec sponsored two of the students to come to the Summer School of Catholic Action in Cumbermere. I was one of them. That was in 1951. So we came by train from Quebec City to Barry's Bay. And I spent the summer here, went back, graduated from high school, came back 1952. Did I mention that there was no electricity here in Cumbermere?
No.
There was absolutely no hydro at all. So it was a real learning experience to live with coal oil lamps, outside Johns, which we still have. But just life without electricity is a lot different. Like ironing your clothes, you have to have a heavy iron that you put on the wood stove to heat up, iron your clothes. Anyway, the whole summer was without electricity. The second year I came back in 1952, there were more staff. The first year there was just about four staff with Catherine and Eddie. There were four or five staff, one man permanent. There were always lots of young people around who would be passing volunteers. They'd come for a week or 2 weeks, sometimes the whole summer, like the summer, like I did for the summer. So in 1953, after summer school in 52, I went back home, came back in 1953 and joined. Now, at that time, Madonna House was not known as Madonna House. We were called Friendship House. Friendship House was started by Catherine in Toronto in the early 30s. And it was mainly during the Depression, and it was a soup kitchen, basically. But they also had study clubs where they were studying the social encyclicals of the church. And they had a library where the men could come in and sit down in the wintertime, warm up, be off the street. But it was mainly an apostolate to the men at that time. Then before the war, she went to New York, to Harlem, where she was very involved in interracial justice. At that time became well known as a lecturer, where she lectured on the social teachings of the church from one end of the country to the other. She was a very dynamic person, speaker. She had a big voice. She would fill a room with her voice and her personality. She had a very commanding personality. She came into a room, you knew she was there. So during this time in Harlem, she did a lot of lecturing. If anybody has the book, Seven Story Mountain, you can read her, Thomas Merton's encounter with her giving a lecture, and it's very, very, very moving, the impression that was made on him. And he later became a Trappist monk. She had a reputation as a renowned speaker. She had a lot of connections with people from one end of the country to the other who supported her work here in Cumbermere. And Madonna House, or Friendship House Canada branch, as we were known, was a rural settlement house. The big thing there was, like, there was no hospital, so the nursing played a big part in the of the life. Like, she herself delivered a baby. Most people, but a lot of people had their babies at home. The nearest hospital was in Pembroke, which was pretty far away in those days. And then some of our nurses that came early on, the one was a midwife, and she would go with Dr. Dooley to deliver babies at home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many babies they delivered, but quite a few. And the staff would go out with Dr. Dooley and the nurse. I went three times out and to help with get the young kids off to school if the baby was
in process.
Had not arrived. Yeah. Somebody would have to get the young kids off to school. So I was sent out once. And then all the staff had to take a Red Cross home nursing course, which we used when we went out to have to a family to help with a sick person. I went out on three of those, and I found out that medicine was not my calling. So she also, and the nurses gave the Red Cross home nursing class, like I know in Palmer Rapids and here in Cumbermere, and I don't remember where else, mm-hmm. but home nursing was a big part until the hospital was built, and that was such a godsend, but it changed our lives. Yeah. I mean, it changed the lives mm-hmm. of the nurses. There was more. We were St. John Ambulance.
Yeah.
That was an important thing in those days.
Yeah.
With no hospital, we took all the highway accident calls. Plus, St. John Ambulance supplied whatever, you know, the stuff the nurses needed for the accidents. We were also, the National Film Board had a lot of educational films, and they supplied us with films and also a projector that we could take to places that had no electricity. And so for a couple of winters, we would take these films around to the places and show them. Now, there was only a couple of places that didn't have electricity. Most places had electricity. But that also, library was a big thing before libraries were very common. We had a lending library where the, I think it was the post office, had some sort of a grant where we would send out books to people with a sticker. They could put the sticker on and return the books free of charge. We had to pay for the postage out, but they could return them free of charge.
Right, so I would say that I was familiar with the staff at St. Joseph's House as I was growing up. Had encounters with them through the parish, through local youth group, and visits to my family. I would say that I got to know St. Joseph's, and you know, I have childhood memories of pulling out the toy box and playing on the floor in that house, you know, searching through St. Ed's shop looking for the perfect Mother's Day gift for my mom. So I remember the attention and attentiveness of the staff to a little child. So one little memory is riding my bicycle along Highway 517 and getting my pant leg caught in the chain of the bicycle. So I was stuck. I was 7 years old, and I thought, you know, I'm going to die here. Nobody's going to come along. This is it. This is the end. And I remember two staff walking along. I recognized them by their Madonna House cross. And I didn't know exactly who they were, but I felt safe. And they walked over to me and offered to help me retrieve my pant leg from my bicycle chain. And I would say that's just kind of an example of the relationship that I had over the years, is one of knowing that these were people who cared about me, who cared about the community, and were just there to be neighbors, good neighbors, and to assist in any way they could. So when I was 20, I was a guest for the first time at the training center and staying at St. Germain's. And I think one of my first impressions was being surprised that there were young people from all over the world who were also guests here, and that we were all kind of seeking. We were seekers and looking for, you know, what's life all about? What am I doing here? What's the purpose of life? I'm looking for meaning. And my experience so far has left me looking for more. So I think I was just looking to go deeper in my faith, learning a little more about what does it mean to be a Christian and a Catholic in the world. I was not looking for a vocation here to Madonna House. So I think that I would say that's what I encountered here, was other young people. We were all kind of searching, and we trusted that this was a place where we could find the truth, find meaning and direction, and that there were elders. So I encountered I would say, mentors in this community, people who along the way were there to guide me and that I could go to with my questions. So I never met Eddie Doherty. He died in 1975, which was the year before I was born. I did meet Catherine Doherty. I only remember one occasion. I have photo evidence of other occasions, but I remember meeting her when I was about 5 years old at a reception at George Vanier Catholic School. And I was prepared for that encounter by my parents. I knew that I was going to be meeting someone important. And I would say that my first impression of her was someone a little larger than life. And a little bit of awe.
So I was working in Ottawa at the hospital, the Civic there, and my life was okay. Anyhow, I made a retreat in December, so I'd only been working there since August. Made a retreat in December that really posed a really important question for me, and I knew I needed some help answering the question. It was kind of like what Christina's talking about. It was to do with more about life, a deeper experience of life. And by that time, I had met two of the priests of Madonna House, just really passing acquaintances, really. But that's who came to my mind as somebody that I could talk to. So I started seeing one of those priests for spiritual direction. I would come home on the weekends from work, and I would make an appointment with him. And he would say to me, wait in the basement. That's how we get into the main house. So that was one of the oddest experiences of my life, is entering. I said, how do you get into this place? And it's through the basement door, which is a little unusual. So anyway, he would say, wait in the basement. And because they were at lunch, and after lunch, he would meet me down there and we would go somewhere to talk. Inevitably, every time I'm waiting for him, because it was always at the same time, I could tell lunch ended by all the chairs scraping up above me. And then all these people went by me. And I grew up here, and I know that Cumbermere is not a big place. And it seems like all these different people. And I said, what the heck? What is this place? Who are all these people, and what could they possibly be doing here? So I would ask Father Tom, I'd say, tell me again what you do here. So he would do his best to explain that people came as working guests, that they would want to participate in our life, maybe for a week, maybe for a month, maybe some people stayed for 6 months. And I could not get my head around that. So that was January of 82. And in August, I had a longer break of days off from work. And I just had this feeling sense, I think I should go to Madonna House and just see what is that place. And so I came, and I worked with Mary Davis for 9 or 10 days. To be perfectly honest, I think I booked off sick for one day to be able to stay a day longer. I did the most unusual things. I washed out filthy, dirty sheepskins. There are sheepskins that had not yet been processed. I mean, the wool was off them, but they were filthy dirty, and they had set up this big bathtub in the main yard here, and Mary set me to cleaning these out, and I was perfectly happy cleaning these filthy, dirty, stinky sheepskins. And then we went cranberry picking out on the bog in the canoes, and I picked chokecherries. And that, I mean, I picked berries from the time I was old enough to move on my own. But there was something about what I was doing here, and there was something about Mary Davis that just caught me. Now, I could not have told you then what it was, but within about 4 or 5 days, I talked to Jean Fox, who was Catherine's assistant at the time. I said, I would like to quit my job and come back. Not to join. I had absolutely no intention of joining, but I wanted to come back and just have a longer period of time here. And she very wisely said to me, wait 3 months, and if you still want to do that, quit your job and come. So that's August. I actually sent in my resignation right away, but effective 3 months from then. But what was so... This is the kind of grace that happens here. About a month after I was here, my brother was killed in a car accident. And it was a couple more months then before I was coming, and I, oh, God was so merciful. This was a place of such gentleness and beauty and care, and some of the people actually, I mean, I'd only been here 9-10 days in August, but a number of people came to Sean's funeral from here, and that really touched me. And so when I came back, the most important thing really was I was able to actually really work through the grief, which I'm quite sure I would not have been able to do outside of here. It's not an easy thing to do. Anyway, it's complicated, but I was able to do that here, and I have always been profoundly grateful. Again, it's just, I find it so hard when I think back to when I very first came. I remember at Sean's funeral, actually, saying to one of my high school teachers, that's actually when I was telling people, they would say, how's it going in Ottawa? And I would say, well, actually, I'm leaving Ottawa. I'm going to go to Madonna House, and people's jaw would drop. And one of my teachers, I always remember this, he said, why are you going there? And I said, because I feel like it's the first place I have ever experienced being loved just for myself, just for being me, Lynn. And he said, what a waste. And interestingly enough, I ran into him not all that long ago, and I reminded him of that conversation and what he said. He said, I would still say that. I said, that's only because you have no idea what my life is. And so that was my first experience, and it was a little unusual, but it was kind of like Christina saying, I met people from all over the world. My first job was baking the bread up at the farm in a Quebec oven, and I knew how to bake bread. That was fine. So we were making, I don't know, it was 20 or 30 loaves a day by hand doing it, and people would help us get it ready for the pans, and then carry it outside, have started the fire in the Quebec oven, pull it forward and out of the oven, put the bread in, and I just loved it. I loved being up at the farm. I loved doing the bread baking, and much to my distress, in about March, that was the beginning of November, I started that, and March, I got moved, my work got moved down to the main house, and the reason they wanted me to come down to the main house was so that I could hear Catherine give spiritual reading at noon. Our practice still is that after lunch, for about 20 minutes, we have usually one of the priests does we're reading from a certain book, he does a reading, and then there's time for people to share or reflect, whatever. But when she was alive, she did that spiritual reading. Yeah. And so she was still coming to the house at noon, and I was working in the kitchen, and she would come in the back door. And when she came in the back door, everything stopped. And she would come in with Father Briere, who was her companion. He was always with her. And she had really bad arthritis in one knee, so she limped badly. She had a cane, and he would be on her other side. And everybody she passed would say, hello, B, hello, B, hello, B. B is, what's that word? Not nickname, but diminutive or whatever you want to say.
Tell how she got that name.
I can't remember. About a little kid in Harlem saying she was like the bees
that gets the honey.
The honey that is the money for our baseball bats and uniforms.
There
and
you
caps.
Go.
It's not for barrenness.
Yeah, that's right.
She stressed it's not for barrenness.
That's right.
And she told that story over and over.
Yeah.
How she got that name, and she loved it.
Yeah. And so we, even those of us who never knew her well, I do anyway, refer to her as B. But anyway, she would come in and she would sit at her table. She had a certain seat and she would sit at her table and Jean Fox would be with her and they would be talking about whatever. And I would be setting the tables, bringing the water, bringing the bread and whatever. And I heard her say to Jean Fox, who is that? Stage whisper. And Jean Fox said to her, that's Lynn Murray. She's from Barry's Bay. And I did not hear the response, and I absolutely pretended I didn't hear anything, because she was really was a huge presence. And it was a bit formidable. Like, she was not somebody I would ever have walked up. Other people have and did, but I would never have just walked up to her and introduced myself and said anything to her. So anyway, so I left after 6 months. I went away, nursed in the States with a group of sisters for a year, and I had a moment one day. Again, just this incredible grace, this moment where I understood that this really was the life God was calling me to. And I, again, wrote to Jean Fox, said, can I come back and be an applicant? She said yes. And so I came back that November and became an applicant in December. That was 1984.
Well, when I got here and as a staff, Bea was the superior, you might say. There was just a couple of men on the staff then, and we were in the process of growing. She was, we were building the big dining room that was getting built. St. Martha's was getting built, a building for staff women, because up until that time we were renting a St. Joseph's building from a hydro, and it was a pretty drafty place in the winter. So we really needed a place for the women's staff
to sleep in. Really, it was a dorm, right? You needed a dormitory.
Yeah,
yeah.
For the men were in the basement of Madonna House. They in the new kitchen, dining room area that was being built. Dormitory for the men in the basement. Half the basement was the men's dormitory, half was their workshop. Well, I mentioned all the activities that we did. One that I left out was there was a government grant called ARDA, which we tried to start a maple syrup co-op, and they got a lot of equipment and people set up, made maple syrup, but it failed because the producers wanted to sell the maple syrup on their own and they didn't want to sell to the co-op. Well, I should go back a little bit. The Canadian bishops used to have meetings in Ottawa in September. And in September of 1953, Bishop Coudert of the Yukon came for a visit, for an extended visit. And he used to sit around, we would sit around in the dining room at night, and he would tell us the stories of the North that just had us all enthralled. We all wanted to go to the Yukon, and he was looking for volunteers. And actually, in the following April, sent three staff up there, and that was our first mission house. The second mission house was Marion Center with Dorothy Phillips. Bea sent her out there with $100 on the train, and she stayed at a convent, and she founded Marion Center.
Edmonton.
We were expanding then. More people were coming and we were opening houses. We would open up a house at the invitation of a bishop of a diocese. The third house we started was in Winslow, Arizona. And then we went to Oregon. We eventually had houses, 9 or 10 houses, I don't remember how many. But that's how it happened. Mm. We opened houses. Whatever the bishop of the diocese asked us to do. Like in Edmonton and Regina, it was soup kitchen for the transient men. One thing that Bea always had as a characteristic of Friendship House, she called it the chit-chat apostolate. Mm-hmm. So whenever we opened a house, the big point was get to know the people, visit the people, and over cups of tea and maybe a cookie or so, you got to know people and the need of the people at that place. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what we did.
And that's still the case in all our houses. Like, so a house, for instance, at Marion Center, Edmonton and Regina both have soup kitchens.
Yeah.
That's their main work in terms of the physical externals. But every house has that part of the apostolate, which is the chit-chat apostolate. It's an open door. People come, and I've run into this, people's amazement, that they say, you mean we don't have to make an appointment? And we say, no, you don't have to make an appointment. If you come and we're here, we put down what we're doing, and we visit with people. Yeah. So Bea eventually would begin to say that the greatest poverty in the world today is loneliness. Mm-hmm. And in all of our houses, we encounter that in people, and we may encounter it in rich people, poor people, middle class people, everybody. And and that's the other thing about every house, like, crosses all these barriers. I was in Arizona one time, and we have a big celebration after the Easter Vigil Mass, and we would invite, we always had friends who were Protestant, who were black, who were white, all kinds of people. And so we would invite them to our house starting about 9 o'clock or 9:30 at night. And they would be lined up waiting to come into the house when we got there. These are people that weren't Catholic. They weren't going to the Mass. So they would all come in and we would celebrate. And I remember so well Mary Jo Jennings saying to us one day, a woman in our neighborhood just started singing out this gospel song from her chair. And Mary Jo turned to me. She said, "Well," she was from the South, "you just never know who you're going to meet here." And it's the truth. And it's one of the most beautiful parts of our life, which it's the same thing here. You never know who you're going to meet here.
Yeah. There's a North American aspect, obviously, places in the U.S. and Canada, but how do you end up in Israel?
The Bishop of Galilee invited us. One of our very close friends from... that was the Devinks. They were a Belgian family in
New Jersey. And
they were sitting in the park speaking French. And this priest came up to him and said, "It's so good to hear this." He did not know English. He was a French-speaking, Arabic-speaking. He had just come from Lebanon as a priest in the parish. He learned English. He was given a parish in Birmingham, Alabama, but he remained friends with the Devinks. And one year they were coming up to Madonna House, and that's another whole interesting story. But anyway, the family used to come up, brought this Father Joe up, and he immediately fell in love with Madonna House. He saw the cross, and he said, he was a Melkite priest. He saw the cross, and he said, "I had a dream. And in the dream, the cross had Pax Caritas on it." He said, "I want that cross." So he and Father Callahan, who was the founder priest, and B got together and they talked. And they said they could start an associate priest membership. Father Cal took his cross off, put it on his neck, and said, "You're now an associate member of Madonna House." Now we have, I think, I don't know how many associate priests from that, from all over the world.
What does Pax Caritas mean?
And they all have the cross. Peace and love.
So the priest's name was Father Joseph Raya.
Raya. Oh, yeah, and he was parish priest in Birmingham, Alabama. Now, B and Father Eddie had taken a promise of chastity because they said, All the staff have to be celibate. So they privately, with permission of the bishop, took vows of celibacy. They used to sleep up in the house. She moved over to the island, and he stayed in the house for sleeping. And he petitioned Rome, or somebody, the bishop, or I don't know the legal stuff, what he had to go through, to be ordained a priest. And because he had been married twice, his both wives had died, but they said he could not be ordained. Father Joe was visiting at the time, and he said, "Eddie, when I'm made a bishop, I'll ordain you." So about 5 years later, he was made Archbishop of Galilee in Israel. So the first thing he did after he was settled, Mr. D, went to Israel, stayed at the bishop's house, and the bishop personally tutored him how to say Mass. That's all, because he was well-learned, that's all he had to know is how to say Mass. So on August 15th, which we're celebrating tomorrow, he was ordained in Israel in the chapel that Charles de Foucault used to pray in.
1969. You know, I think it might be worth going back a little bit about Madonna House. And so, for instance, the Toronto connection. So Catherine left Toronto, and she went down to Harlem. That was the end of Friendship House in Toronto. She went down to Harlem. Friendship House began again. And same thing, people gathering around her, and then they opened other houses. She left that community. She stayed connected with them as the director of the community, but in all, truly, she was no longer a part of the community.
And Friendship House.
That was Friendship. So we were called Friendship House Canada here.
Yeah.
For how long, Mary? Until
maybe
when?
Mid-50s.
Okay, mid-50s. But for all intents and purposes, she was no longer a part of the Friendship House. They had a difference of opinion about the vision for Friendship House. That was, she felt it was not what God was calling her to, and so she came here with Eddie to retire. They came in 47. She was 51 years old, and she never wanted to form a community anywhere, but people just kept coming and wanting to stay with her. So like Mary's describing, the early 50s, so by this time there's still no formal arrangement in Madonna House, but she went to the Lay Congress in 1951 and in Rome, and while she was there she had first an interview with Cardinal Montini, who would become Pope Paul VI, and he spoke to her on behalf of Pope Pius XII.
She also had an interview with the Pope.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the Pope, they asked her, it was the Pope asking her to formalize the community. He knew who she was, and he felt it was important to formalize the community so that they were under the umbrella of the church in a canonical way. And so she came home. Long story short, that was when the community began taking promises of poverty, chastity, and obedience under the local bishop here in Pembroke. So that was the beginning of the formal.
That was in 1954 that we took that we voted on whether or not to become a full-time vocation. Mm-hmm. Up until that time, people would commit themselves for a year. She used to say, think of yourself in Friendship House in a room that has many doors in it. One door says marriage, one says priesthood, one door says monastery, one monastery marriage. One door says single life dedicated in the world. She said, don't you open any door until it opens for you. Hmm. A door will open and you will walk through it. Otherwise, stay in Madonna House until that door opens.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, how do you define it? Like some people, it's a cloister, it's a mm-hmm. monastic place. Is there a formal, no, I'm not looking for the legal term, but how do you define what Madonna House is?
Lay apostolate. So apostle is one who is sent, and a lay person, it's ordinary person who's called to take the gospel, the good news, wherever they go. So we dedicate our lives to that, to bringing the good news to others.
How do you differ, though, from, and again, mm-hmm. correct me if I'm wrong, I always got the impression there were a lot more women here than men. And mm-hmm. the question I was asked by people who thought I knew something about Madonna House was, well, why aren't they all nuns? Why don't they join the Sisters of St. Joseph
or the
Gray Sisters?
That's a very good point, because the Catholic world was very slow to accept an apostolate with men, women together. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to give your life to the church, join a convent, join a monastery, become a priest, become a brother. And especially in Catholic circles, a lot of people had trouble with that idea of men and women together. They still do.
Yeah, it was not at all understood. You have to understand there were no women in the church speaking the way Catherine Doherty and Dorothy Day were doing, certainly not in North America, or forming these communities. Now, Catholic Worker never formalized their community as far as I know. And so it was the same when we began. I don't know that there was any other community like us. Lay people, which means we're ordinary. You're a lay person. You're a layman. So we're called to live an ordinary, simple life and living it with great love. And we happen to dedicate our life to Madonna House, to the spirit of Madonna, to God, through the spirit of Madonna House, and which is a particular charism, a particular way of living within the church. And, I mean, there are many aspects to our particular way of life that are incredibly life-giving. We have a family camp in the summer, Cana Colony. All kinds of families have come. That was the other thing. Pope Pius said to be, remember the family. So they came back and they bought the property at Bennett Lake and began family camps.
Actually, it started before that.
Okay.
The first summer school in 1951 was just all summer school. She went to Rome. After the Pope said, remember the families, the last week of summer school was family week.
Mm.
And at that time, Father Cal came,
who was involved
in the family movement, CFM, in Rochester, New York. And the first families that came were families in the CFM from Rochester.
CFM is the Christian Family Movement.
And then he had some money. He bought St. Anne's property, which had a lake on it. Well, it's where it is now. A farmhouse and a lake. And as he got money, he built cottages there. And that's where Family Week is now. Mm-hmm. But first, Family Week was held here at
right.
Madonna House.
And at St. Joe's,
at
right?
St. Joe's.
The kids were at St. Joe's or something, yeah.
Over the years, we've received up to 48 families over 6 weeks in the summer at our family camp, Cana Colony. And those families come mostly from Canada, some from the U.S., and it's a place for them to be nurtured in their family life and for them to be restored, really, as a family. So we provide that, again, in response to Pope Pius XII's invitation, remember the family. So here in Combermere, with guests, the numbers can be up to 80 at the main house, and 40 to 50 at St. Mary's, so that overall, I think 190 would be a rough number of the staff worldwide. So in Canada, we have missions in Ottawa, Toronto, Windsor, and then the rural apostle at St. Joseph's House here in Combermere. We're also in Regina, Edmonton, and Vancouver in Canada. And then in the U.S., Yukon. Yes, Alpena, Michigan, Washington, D.C., Roanoke, Virginia, Salem, Missouri, and Winslow, Arizona. So those are our U.S. houses. In Europe, we have a house in Belgium, one in England, and then Russia and Carriacou would be the foreign.
Which is the West Indies.
West Indies.
Carriacou. It's part of Grenada. So the thing is that over the years, we have, I don't know how many houses we've opened, but it's true. We've been in two houses in France. Where else have we been in Europe? That might be, we were in East Pakistan, Israel, Peru, Brazil, Honduras,
Ghana,
Liberia, and then other houses in Canada and the United States. Yeah. And those houses closed for a variety of reasons. Sometimes we just kind of work ourselves out of a job. Like as the church strengthens and grows in some of these places, other people are doing what we did, and we're not needed there anymore. Sometimes it's because we are growing ourselves in other ways, and we need staff to be able to take on other works that are needed, and so some of those houses have closed on that account.
There is a discernment process, so between the community and the person, the candidate, who's looking at this way of life, there are, you know, there's a period of really trying out the vocation. That's a year and 9 months. It's called applicancy.
Yeah.
So someone who is very seriously looking at a life given to service in the church, so you must be Catholic, and, you know, willing to really go wherever you're sent, wherever you're needed. So there's a willingness and a freedom to lay down your life in service to the poor, whether it's the rich poor, but those who do not know that they are loved, that God loves them. So there is a discernment process, and I would say Catherine and those who directed the community after her would sometimes send someone away because they did not see the vocation or it needed to be tested. So they might say, you know, go back home and live the gospel in your own community.
You know, the bishop was just here. We have our directors' meetings every year. All the directors of all the houses come back every year for 2.5 weeks of meetings to talk about some of these things, like how are we going to continue. Some of the changes that have happened in Madonna House is we've gotten older. And part of the reason we've spread out so much. Like St. Mary's is a separate community from, we call ourselves the training center. So the guests, the working guests come here. They work with us here. They live, they sleep, they, with as part of this community. There's another community at St. Mary's, which is the old FCJ convent. And that is also a vibrant house, but it's very different. And for one thing, it has accessibility for people with mobility issues. Yeah. And we have added onto it a small place where some of our people who are need some extra care, and so we look after them there, and it's just a better setup for people. People who are dying, we try to bring them home so they can die here, and we look after them with, thanks be to God, for the healthcare services that are around us. So that's part of the changes that have happened, and so yes, there has been a need every year, always, to look at, you would say, the human resources and say, how are we going to continue to do this? And there are practical considerations that have to be made. Sometimes we do have to close a house and say, this is not tenable anymore. Or I came back, I was at a field, in a field house, a mission house, for 5.5 years, my first mission, and I came back to help with the nursing here because I had a nursing background. So those decisions are made, but it was interesting. The bishop, our Bishop Guy, came last week to listen, really, to our directors. He's a relatively new bishop, and he doesn't really know that much about us. And so he wanted to hear, what are you doing and what are you seeing in the world? What are you experiencing? And one of the questions he asked, well, Christina can answer this better, was, are you afraid or are you worried?
Or what is your plan for the future?
And our answer was God. I mean, ultimately, that's what it is. Yeah. That if this is of God, then all we need to do, I'm saying all, but it's a big ask, is to pay attention. What is God asking of us? And sometimes it seems really clear. Sometimes it's not clear. Sometimes there's a lot of waiting before there's a clear word about how to move forward. And those decisions, those big decisions, are made. So we have laymen, laywomen, and priests are the three branches of the house, of the community. And so each of those branches has a director general, and they are elected by the membership of the branch. And those three together, and this is absolutely unique in the church, there's nothing like this in the church, those three together make decisions, major decisions, for the community as one. One person does not have a greater say than either of the others. They work together, and it's a point of unity for the community, and we are beginning to see more and more and more that is our major charism, is this grace of unity that we are called to live. And that's why we're men, women, and priests. We're clergy and laity. We're men and women. We deal with all the same issues that most people deal with on an individual, personal, communal, couples even, you know, a lot of the issues working out. Men see things differently than women do. How do we work these things out in a way that is respectful, charitable, loving? And that's what we do every day, and hundreds of times a day. Anyway, managing... we have in place people who are responsible. They're local directors. We have a local director here at the training center, one for the women, one for the men, and an assistant priest to the director general priest. They make the decisions on the local, right here for the training center. There is a local director at St. Mary's. She does the same. Every field house has a local director. So the directors general don't have to get involved in all the minutiae of every house. They know what's happening in every house. They're kept up to date. But those local directors make the decisions with consultation from the people they're living with. And we believe strongly in the grace of state. This is, if we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, then God is directing this.
I know you have the restoration, and it's still around, because I see it every so often in various places. I saw one yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where does that... Is that Eddie, or is this...
He started it.
Okay.
He was the editor as long as he lived.
It began as the social forum. B always had, from the beginning in Toronto in 30, she had something that she was sending out.
Yeah.
And she had a huge readership, actually, in Toronto. And it was called the social forum. And when they came here, I'm not sure how it got changed. Maybe the social forum still existed in Friendship House, but so it was called Restoration because the part of our charism, the call is to restore all things in Christ. And so this is Restoration, and that would be the primary aim of the newspaper in a broad sense.
So they were publishing it the year they arrived here, which was 1947. Yeah. It was already in the works, and from there, initially, Catherine Doherty and Eddie were the writers, but as staff came, they began writing, and eventually Catherine was asking the staff.
Eddie Doherty wrote until he died. He was a real newspaper man. He was one of the top newspaper reporters in the United States at one time. Do you know how he met the Bee? He was doing a story on Harlem, the wickedest city in New York, and she took great exception to that and threw him out, but he kept coming back.
How did they end up picking Cumbermere as the place to start
out? That happened was Bee had a cousin, Nicholas Maklitzoff, who was a great fisherman. He and Oscar, this other fellow, used to come up fishing in the area. He saw this property. He was intending to get married, and he bought the property, 5 acres, and built a house, built this house, a six-room house. And he used to invite, or she invited herself, Bee and the staff in Harlem to get out of the city in the summer for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. So they would come up here to Cumbermere as sort of a retreat vacation. From the city.
When would she be doing that? Like, this is the late...
That would be 45, 46. So when Bishop William J. Smith was the new bishop of this diocese, he was making the rounds of the parishes, and he was at, by this time it was Canadian Martin.
Sacred
Heart Church. There was a big reception. I mean, all the parishioners went to meet the bishop, and she talked to the bishop at that time about opening up a friendship house and got his permission to open this up. And so that happened in 1947 when that trouble was in the United States.
And Eddie bought it, right?
He had the money to buy the property.
Well, and is this property?
Five acres.
The original house.
It was just a six-room house.
Oh, okay.
And when they came, shortly after, when I came in 51, there was a six-room house, a chicken coop, a hen house, St. Peter's. This St. Veronica's was used for visiting priests, but it wasn't this building. It was a different building. This wasn't here. This wasn't here. That's all there was in the yard. So they didn't start building on the property until 1952.
Why does it still exist, and what makes this place work?
I would say that there is a hunger for God in the human person, and that's universal. And however people express it, whether they know it or not, there's each person is hungering for communion with their Creator. And I think we've been blessed here to encounter God in a very personal way. We call it the duty of the moment. So it's what the work I have to do on any given day, what is in front of me. Am I putting a meal on the table? Am I cleaning something? Am I nursing somebody? But whatever it is that I'm doing, the duty of the moment is to do it with my whole heart, with all my energy, to give everything I have to this task, and to know that's meaningful. It gives me meaning, it gives others meaning, and it's there's a power in that encounter with reality, with the ordinary things of daily life, that transforms the world. So there's an invisible aspect to this, but this is what I've encountered and what I hear from others who come here, that there's something very concrete here. It's in every ordinary moment of human existence that it's just shot through with power and meaning because God is there. God is present to us and we encounter Him. So nothing's stopping that from happening. Nothing is stopping us from sharing that with others, that every single human person, their life has meaning. Whether they're flat on their back in a nursing home, whether they are President of the United States of America, if they do what they're doing, what they can do with love, if they're given to that, with, you know, every ounce of their energy, that changes the world. And it may be invisible, But what is invisible very quickly becomes visible when we call it incarnation, but it's basically we put flesh on the gospel by loving.
I've been thinking about this a lot. The thing that I would say is that everyone experiences what I experienced when they come here, which is that they are respected as an individual. And so to join the community, you have to be Catholic and you have to be free. You can't be married to somebody. You can't have young children. You can't have huge debts. You have to be free. But to come and live here, anybody can come as long as they are able and willing to actually enter into what is our life. And when you come, one of the rules, quote unquote, that we try to live by is you don't ask personal questions. So the first question out of my mouth to you is not, what do you do? In other words, I'm identifying you with what you do. Where do you live? There's a variety of reasons for that. It leaves people free. That's the ultimate thing. But it's a much deeper thing. It's communicating to people that you are important, and it's you that I want to encounter, you the person. And I think that's always been a desire of the heart of anybody, that I want to be known, I want to be loved, I want to be received and accepted and respected. And I think in this day and age, it's always been that way, I suppose, that there have been challenges in that. I think it's a huge need in our current climate of division everywhere, for instance. And so because of what you believe is not what I believe, I don't talk to you. Right? And to get past that, and we have individuals to the max in Madonna House. I used to say that I think we have more eccentrics in Madonna House per capita than anywhere in the world. The truth is, people are allowed to be who they are. And the bottom line is love. Bea wrote in a staff letter to all of us at one time in her life, if you are not loving one another where you are, talking to people in the field houses, if you are not loving one another, it does not matter what you do. Close the door of your house until you can love one another, because nothing else matters. The rest will be chaff in the air unless we love. And you cannot love someone without accepting the differences. I don't have to agree with you, but I can accept that there is a difference here. I don't have to like, I don't have to agree with what you're saying, but to treat you with the dignity that you deserve. And that was a big part of what I experienced when I very first came to Madonna House. It didn't matter where I came from. Didn't matter who I was. I just felt absolutely absorbed into the life of this place just for being me. And that has never left me.
I agree with everything that both of you said. I think, boy, you've hit it right on. One thing I would add is that the message we have, we call it the Living Nazareth, the simple, ordinary life, that through living that life, you can achieve sanctity. It gives people hope.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people passing through here, I think they get hope mm-hmm. when they leave.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, again, I don't know whether I heard it before, but I'd certainly forgotten it until I'm doing what's called the site check. I came down here like 3 or 4 weeks ago to meet with Mary Lynn, and we're walking through, and I hadn't been inside the place that I'd come through the basement probably in 40 years, maybe even longer, 50. And I look up and I see this little, it's like a bumper sticker thing, and it said, I am third. And before I could mentally process the fact that I knew that, because I'd heard that before somewhere, I turned to Mary Lynn and I say, what's that? And she says, well, that's who we are. I am third. There's God, there's my neighbor, and then there's me.
Yeah.
And I remember going home, and I think, I have heard that before. And I still don't know whether it was the Baroness or Eddie or somebody sitting beside me at one of those lentil dinners, but it, to me, that is the golden jelly of Madonna House. Because, and to your point, mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's, and I'm not denigrating the term love. Love is an ethereal thing. When you said putting flesh on it, it's the action of Madonna House, the ability to do things, to put yourself third, to put an action at the center of a relationship where you don't ask somebody what they do, but you do something to benefit them because you're motivated by a Christian God. That, to me, is the royal jelly. You don't have Madonna House unless you have all of those things you do, ambulance services, clothing, furniture, all of the things you do. That's an act of love, but it's an act. It's a thing you do. It's a gift to your neighbor. It's a concern for the well-being of others. And I was quite intrigued at the conversation about, you know, even the rich are lonely. Yeah, that's very true. But that is the feeling you project to the local community. And I think that is the fundamental royal jelly that keeps you moving forward. Mm-hmm. I still don't know how the hell you do it, because it shouldn't work in theory as a, call it a corporation. It's hard to do that, to be third all the time. It's like I have too much vanity and pride to do that.
But you know you're called to that. I would take exception to what you just said. I think everybody is called to that. It is the call. And it doesn't, we don't have to be thinking in terms of a Christian God. That happens to be our tradition. But and it's the hardest part of this life. It's the hardest part of life, I think. And you, I'm sure you have lived it as a husband and a father, to surrender my will. And to, which is, I am speaking for myself, it's been the hardest part of living this life for me, is surrendering my will, being willing to take the third place. And whether it's because I have an opinion, I have a wish, I have a good idea, whatever it is, to be able to surrender to something greater that is being asked of me. And it doesn't mean that I don't get to express my opinion or whatever, but there's a whole other level of living that we heard the gospel this morning. I've come to bring fire on the earth. That's the fire. It's to purify our hearts in order that to make room for God. And it's God who will allow us and give us what we need to be third and be filled with joy third. Joy was what I experienced from Mary Davis when I came. Mm-hmm. You and Sandra Woods. I saw women who were so happy. You loved not just what you were doing that day, you loved this life. And that was the big mover for me, more than anything else.
I wanted to share something, and this is from a local history of Holy Canadian Martyrs Parish. So this was something that was spoken by one of our priests, Father Robert Pelton, who was the first man to be ordained a priest for Madonna House. And it was at Catherine Doherty's funeral, so that was 1985. I was 9 years old, and I was there. So Father Pelton says, when Catherine and Eddie came here in 1947, they were emotionally beaten up. She found in this humble place, and through the kind people, who were simply good neighbors to her, the courage and the strength not only to go on, but to listen even more deeply to Christ and to begin something new. I hope that every person from this village understands what it means that this great woman will always be known not simply as Catherine of the Cross, but as Catherine of Combermere. You too have fulfilled the gospel Catherine gave her life for. She was a stranger and you welcomed her. So I think you mentioned, Barry, that bumper sticker, I am third. Well, there's another bumper sticker that is over our door going into the basement, and that is, a stranger is a friend I haven't met yet. So that, what Catherine experienced here from the local people, the welcome, I think that was something that I would say I experienced when I first came here as a guest, and I wouldn't have been able to articulate it then. But I can now, that I was welcomed, and I was welcomed for who I was. And that is something that I still experience. And I would say will this continue? Will this way of life continue? Well, I want to give my life to do that for others. So to welcome the stranger who crosses our doorstep and to let them know that they're important to me, to the Lord, to this community. And that's something that we learned here. Catherine learned it from the local people.
For me, there's probably lots of things, but what comes to my mind is what has changed is when I first came back to be an applicant, I was terribly unhappy about coming. I had always thought I would be married, and I wanted to be married. I wanted to be married. I wanted children. I was happy to stay in Barry's Bay or this area, and I could not let go of that. And I was so dogged by that, and it lasted. So 2 years of applicancy, and then first promises, and then 7 years in promises before I made my final promises in 1993. And it wasn't until 6 months before I made my final promises that I realized I was no longer fighting this. And that was pure grace. It was just gone. And so what has changed is not just an acceptance of what God has called me to, which could sound very grudging, actually. I love this life. And I believe so deeply in it. And I believe that you mentioned this yourself, that so we're just this little tiny pocket of people living a very humble, simple life. And yet we know that it's like this radiation of God's grace throughout the world, and it's the thousands of people who've come and shared it with us, but it's because we're all connected in God. And I want one day to be able to be what Mary Davis was for me, a woman who is so passionately in love with what God has given her. And can, just by my life, I don't even know I'm doing it. Mary Davis didn't know she was doing it. But just by my life, by embracing this life that God has given to me, that other people see, have that encounter with God themselves.
I can't add to what you guys said.
Oh, Mary, you can.
No, I can't.
Oh, yes, you can. 5 years from now.
5 years from now, I will be in the kingdom.
What's been the greatest joy of your life here in Madonna House?
Oh, there's been so many.
Just pick one.
I think the staff, my brothers and sisters here, although it's not always easy to live with them, but they're my brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that touched me very much is when I turned 80 years old. I worked mainly in the gardens my whole apostolic life. And I had a saw that I liked, but the saw was very dull. I couldn't use it anymore. And it was a saw that would fold up. So I sort of threw it away. On my 80th birthday, I got the saw back. It was fixed. It was sharpened. And on the handle, it was written, "Happy 80th birthday."
Oh, that's great, Mary.
One of my brothers did that.
One of our priests, Father Emile Briere, who lived in a little cabin over on the island, when I was an applicant, so this is 1998, 1999, I was asked to bring his supper to him. At that time, he was living in the cabin as a pustinik, which is a word, Russian word meaning desert or hermitage or a hermit. And I would drop off his supper on the way to Mass every evening, and after the evening liturgy, I would return through a path on the island and pick up his dishes. And I can't tell you how many times he said to me, "Pass it on."
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I guess, the word that remains with me is Catherine had, gifts. I can't even describe what a gifted person she was. In order to found this place, the order that you see here. This is beautiful. People walk onto our property and they're stunned by the gardens, which Mary has been pouring her life into for over 50 years, the beauty, and that it continues. I mean, it's continuing to exist. That in itself is kind of stunning. But Father Breer would say to me, pass it on. And what are we passing on? And I think that's the mystery, is what we've received. And it's this incarnational way of life, this way of clothing the gospel with our flesh. So the gospel means good news, but to be a walking gospel, what does that mean? Yeah. And so that's what comes to me, is the pass it on, and that I want to continue to do that. You asked, like, what will I be doing in 5, 10, 15 years? That's what I'll be doing. I don't know what it'll look like, yeah, but I will be passing it on in any way I can.
I think that we cannot celebrate 75 years without a mention of our benefactors, because we only exist because of our benefactors. So whether it's buttons people send us, or a car that has a few more years use in it, or money which pays our bills, Bea felt very strongly that we were never to be anything other than beggars, which is a reminder of our need for God. And because people believe in what we're doing, they support us. And I am so conscious of that, that without them, none of us would be here. And without them, there will be no Madonna House, because that is an immovable part of our life. And I am moved to tears sometimes. I work in our business office, so I do some of the receipting, and we all take turns writing. We write a thank you to every single person that sends us anything, if we have their name and address. And we have money that's been coming in from some woman, $2 a year for 50 years. Or there's a monk in the United States sends us $2 a year. And, I mean, so we also receive larger donations, for which we're grateful, but it is often the widow's mite that is what we live from. And we pray for our benefactors every single day, never forgetting that without them, there is no Madonna House. So I would like to say thank you.
That was Mary Davis. Mary Lynn Murray and Christina Milan was in conversation with Barry Conway. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for the producer of the Op Yonga Line, Barry Conway, we'd like to wish Mary Davis, Mary Lynn Murray, Christina Milan, and all the staff of Madonna House another 75 years of showing the world what true Christian charity really looks like, day in and day out. Good day, and God bless.